Hello and welcome to the Scale Podcast. We are pleased to announce that Scale 4X, the 2006 Southern California Linux Expo, will be held on February 11th and 12th, 2006 at the Los Angeles Airport Westin. If you are interested in attending, exhibiting, or presenting, please see our website at www.socallinuxexpo.org. Today's presentation comes from our 2005 conference, Scale 3X, and is titled Globalization of Grassroots Technologies in India. Our speaker is Sumitra Srinivasan, who is a PhD student in communications at Georgia State University. She will discuss her research on how open source software is transforming the digital divide in India. Slides and notes from today's presentation are available on our website at socallinuxexpo.org/podcast.
Hello. I'm Sumitra. My last name is too long. It's pronounced Srinivasan. Just call me Sumitra. I'm a PhD student at Georgia State University. I'm in the fourth year, and I'd like to say I'm not writing my dissertation. I'm still involved in the data collection phase and, you know, still looking towards crystallizing some of my ideas. But yeah, I'm a fourth-year PhD student, and most of my research is in the area of open source, and I approach it from a globalization-slash-political economy standpoint. All of you are industrial technical experts here. I'm not. I'm from the Department of Communication equal to mass communication. We deal with film aesthetics and theory, interpersonal communication, health communication. So this is really a new area to our department as well. How I became interested in this area, in my bachelor's, I did physics. That was my major, physics, electronics. At that time, I was reporting for my college newspaper, so I found it very difficult to get away from the physics lab as well as get away from my newspaper beats. So I wanted to find a middle ground, and I found this program which offered journalism, advertising, / electronic media technology. So that was sort of the right mix. I took it, and then I went on to specialize in television, radio, film at Syracuse University, Newhouse School of Public Communication. And from there, I came to Georgia State. So that's how MassCom/technology interest came to be. So this is derived from my dissertation work and some data collection that I did over last semester and over the winter break in India. This looks at open source technologies, FLOSS, free libre open source software, particularly in the context of developing countries. And I take the case study of India because I'm from India. I know the scenario there before and after the advent of Linux and such open source applications. So that's my topic. I'm going to explore how the digital divide is transformed by the advent of open source, and how it's changing the face of globalization, and how government and corporate controls have, are swaying to open source adoption, and how probably they may try to counter the development of open source as well in India. So digital divide technologies rule. We're looking at globalization via technoscapes of grassroots power, the grassroots power being open source technology, which encourages community building of software. And technoscapes is a term that I borrow from Arjuna Padurai. He's a scholar who studied globalization, and he proposes to look at globalization as five scapes. He doesn't want to say places or spaces, but he says they are scapes because they are a fluid, abstract medium just out there spreading to globalize. So he looks at technoscapes, which is basically how technology brings about globalization. He looks at mediascapes, where he talks about mass media and how they bring about globalization. Financescapes, flow of money and capital across multiple production centers. One other scape. And ideoscape, how ideologies work in bringing about cultural influences in the globalization platform. So that's a term I borrow simply because this is all about technology. I want to thank you all for allowing me to share my thoughts, because this is totally, it's from a very cultural angle. It's from a globalization, cultural studies angle that I'm looking at technology. So I want to introduce you to, you know, a bird's eye view of some globalization theories that tout technology's influence in globalization. Talele is an eminent scholar who a lot of other scholars say is technologically deterministic because he hails technology. He says technology is the root cause of globalization. Without technology, globalization could not exist. Some other scholars like Toffler and some also tout technology's power to globalize and to transcend the core and the periphery, core being the first world, the periphery being the third world countries. But there are some other scholars who don't think technology is the only answer to globalization. They think that the digital divide still exists, and government factors, corporate factors contribute to manipulate the digital divide and, you know, and widen it even further. So there are two aspects of the digital divide that's there in theory: technological and informational divides between developed and developing countries. Technological divide being access to resources, hardware, software, the ability to invest in the infrastructure, etc. That would be the technological divide. The informational divide is basically lack of awareness, lack of content tailored for the developing countries that are in a nascent phase with respect to developing open source technology and applications. So language and culture also create a sort of a resistance to technology. We look at that in detail in the following sections. This is just a little statistic there. The global digital divide versus the local digital divide. Out of the, there are 429 million people, so that's 6% of the world population, versus 41% of the 6% who have access to technology are North American. So that's the extent of the global digital divide as well as the local digital divide that that exists within North America. The state and the market, traditional notions of power as vested in the government, as vested in the corporations. Lawrence Lessig talks about it too, the growing dominance of the East Coast code with, as opposed to the West Coast code. He laments about that. So in some examples that I've given here, blocking of websites and news portals and censorship of search engines like Yahoo. So the state and the market do have a say. Technology is supreme. It can transcend time and space. It can transcend geographical and political boundaries. Yet it's the political people that manipulate technology to their own agendas. So there are some examples here, some events where China blocked the Google search engine this was in September 2002, and that's the blocking of Yahoo because they supposedly indulged in Nazi memorabilia, I think. Well, that's ironical. China blocks a press freedom site, and it's suspected that the blocking follows a press release issued by the group regarding the extended imprisonment of cyber dissident Liu Di, who disappeared in 2002. The more examples, American women's lifestyle site iVillage.com was blocked in Saudi Arabia because they thought the content was sexually explicit or it was about religion and denouncing it. And China reblocks news sites, so it's just not once that they do it. So whether power is a question to ask, does it lie in technology? Does it lie in the traditional institutions? I think that's what a lot of scholars like Milton Mueller and Lawrence Lessig, Schiller, all of them are trying to sort of trash it out and see which is the stronger, technology or the traditional notions of power. So Mueller talks about institutionalization in his book Ruling the Root, where he says he looks into semantics and says, who determines semantics? Is it by virtue of my wanting the name first, or is it because Pepsi.com has the name Pepsi? So if I, as a student at Georgia State, happen to love Pepsi despite being in Coke Country, Atlanta, so if I have student.gsu.edu/tilda-srinivasan, that's how my last name is pronounced, /ilovepepsi.html, then I could be sued for trademark infringement because I used the name Pepsi. So that's a possibility is what Milton Mueller was addressing in his book. So even though it's just Pepsi, it's just a name, I happen to have the website first, Pepsi still has a say because it's trademark infringement. So again, where is the institutionalization? Talele and Dan Schiller talk about commercialization, where Internet Explorer sets his homepage to Amazon, etc. Of course, Lessig talks about the regulability of the Internet and new communication technology. He says that, you know, while talking about intellectual commons, he says there is the East Coast Code is gaining more importance, East Coast Code being Washington, D.C. legislation, law, and West Coast Code is the programming. So it's a, that East Coast Code is gaining more prominence in these years. So one look at the couple of technologies which are an alternative grassroots approach, and they seem to tell me that they seem to manifest the technoscapes of power, peer-to-peer being one and flaws technologies being one. Now government and corporate forces are, you know, acknowledging the importance of these technologies and are adopting them as a government initiative, as a corporate initiative. Of course, Napster was shut down, but that was because it was legally shut down for having a centralized database of users, so it's not really P2P. But of course, programs like Kazaa and Nutella still exist. They exist because they can just move to Netherlands when the United States court imposes a lawsuit on them. So they still exist. They still exist as alternate approaches to, I wouldn't say circumvent, but to challenge the traditional vested interest in power. So these are my research questions. Are there power shifts from centers of politics and commerce to that of technology, given that we're talking so much about freedom, free, libre, open source software? So do these technologies really have the power in them to shift power from the government to technology, from the corporate to technology? And is the community building approach to programming, so the community building of technology, is that closing the digital divide, given that programmers from all over the world code and make multiple versions of Linux or other such applications? My third question would be, do grassroots movements of technology development endo homogeneity or heterogeneity? To me, open source software and such community building of technology is a social movement. It's this moment in globalization that has awesome manifestations. Just because information is created at both global and local levels and is also transmitted across global and local levels. Now, when I went to India, I found that some remote village in Tamil Nadu, it's not a city, it's not a town, it's a remote village, that has an Indian Linux user group. They're called ILUGs. So I don't know if they are active. The meetings were not scheduled very regularly, but they have an online presence. So that's amazing to me. Yet another village near Shimoga has an Indian Linux user group. So it's really great. It's a social movement that enables the first world and third worlds to put their heads together and make something. So it sort of erases the differences between the first and the third worlds. So that's what I'm talking about in homogeneity and heterogeneity. We'll come to informational imperialism in a little bit, but that's another question I want to ask. Is there informational imperialism, which is content production for the developing countries in their native language, because the applications have to be tailored in their native languages? Content production may not exist. Linux magazines in India are just a recent venture. It's just begun a year ago. So in terms of that, in the terms of the way we think, Gayatri Spivak wrote a piece on Can the Subaltern Speak? She was talking about post-colonialism and how colonies, even though they've got the freedom, they still are influenced by some ideas that were passed on to them by the colonizers. So can the subaltern really speak? So even though we have open source technologies, can the internet subaltern really speak, is what I am trying to ask there. And I will look at those questions based on some of these differences between proprietary and open source software. Copyright versus copyleft. All of us know about that, right? And Microsoft Windows and Linux, consumerism, commodity building versus community building. So if you look at developing countries, the digital divide manifests in these forms. They don't have the ability to invest in the infrastructure. They may have the intellectual capital, but that is outsourced. So they don't have the ability to invest in the infrastructure and in the development itself. And lack of adequate representation of developing countries and content published by them and for them. Which means if you were to develop an application, an open source application in Kannada, you need to like do everything from the fonts to the spacing to the cursor position. Documentation is not available. It's not already there. So in that way, are we handicapped? So the technology versus informational device, they keep influencing each other. So it's sort of a vicious cycle. And hence, there's dependency on the West. Even now, if we look at the Linux blogs, there are a lot of... I think most of the material, most of the articles published come from the West. Is that right? Or do we have, we definitely have articles from Indians who are creating their own localization projects, but most of it is from here. Would I be right in saying that? You guys know better than me because, okay. So hence, I see a dependency on the West, and even though we have technology, even though we have a proliferation of open source, the digital divide still widens, is what I think. I want to look at India as a specific case study. It has a population greater than 1 billion, and out of the 1 billion, 73.2% is rural, and 26.8% is the urban population. By rural, I don't mean they are illiterate. They are literate in their own native languages. They're well-versed. They write poetry in their native languages. They're just not conversant in English, which makes it a handicap for them to deploy these open source technologies, because currently we don't have native language documentation. Thing is, India has 18 official languages and so many variations of dialects. So I get a culture shock if I go from one state to another. Here there's Macy's everywhere, there's McDonald's everywhere, but there I get a culture shock. So it's really different. So to make open source applications for the country is not a, it's really a big deal, because you need to look at these different dialects, these different languages, and then have documentation and then make people implement it. It's a huge task ahead. So this was India pre-entry of FLOSS. Again, barriers to technology usage and growth because of the high cost factor, language, culture, and utility differences, and rampant piracy. Microsoft products were really pirated a lot. I think it's probably come down due to the fact that people developed their own applications, but there was a lot of Microsoft piracy. And hence, they did not have any incentive. There was no reason for them to make their own operating systems. They just would pirate CDs. They would just use the applications. And sometimes it would, it works like outsourcing, where you work for a Western company. So there is no incentive to develop an indigenous software there. So we became exporters of intellectual capital to the West. Immigration, outsourcing recently. So now that we have FLOSS, this is what I was talking about. There are 62, I should have expanded that, Indian Linux user groups. They have a presence online, and they meet in universities or a common place bimonthly, every month. It depends on the chapter. But there are totally 62. They've probably increased as we speak. They're voluntary organizations, and they reach remote places. It's amazing that they're all voluntary and they are there. They're sprouting everywhere. Some press reports about FLOSS entry in India. IBM has launched a desktop computer preloaded with the Linux operating system. So you see corporate forces also acknowledging the importance of Linux and hence adopting it in some way. Linux-based handhelds mark India's entry into hardware. And the government, this was in 2002, the government of India announces a Linux India initiative, adopting it in all government activities, and they started it with Road Transport Office. So they developed their own application. So that was a huge deal because the government acknowledges Linux. About the same time, we have the William and Melinda Gates Foundation grants $100 million for an HIV/AIDS initiative in India. You see another news item about Microsoft establishing a $400 million fund for various development projects in India. Bill Gates announces an additional $20 million to spread computer education in Indian schools. And somewhere in there, Microsoft also became the commercial investor in the Media Lab Asia project, investing $1 million, bringing the total up to $421 million. So there was a press report that said that means that Linux is more than four times worse than AIDS to Bill G and his Happy Redmond family. Some political economy there. Bill Gates coaxed Indian engineers on Wednesday to use his firm's proprietary software as he dismissed threats to his Windows system from rival Linux in the battle over network computing. Gates ducked a couple of Linux-related questions before replying to appointed questions on Linux with a dig at Sun. He says, there is a visible shift in Unix space from Sun platforms to Linux. In fact, it is Sun which is losing market share to Linux. So I should have mentioned the papers. I'm sorry I didn't do that. I will probably update it and put it up on the website so you know the source as well. So there is a power shift, or at least it's beginning to shift from copyright to copyleft, which engenders creativity and not commodity. The most common complaint that media scholars have about copyright and intellectual property laws is that they no longer protect the creativity, protect the author. They support economic growth of the owner of the copyright, and the owner does not necessarily have to be the author or the creator of the copyright. So that's a common complaint. So the GPL and copyright probably would address that. Governments, not only the Indian government, but other governments have also adopted open source globally. Well, they have a political economy motive as well. It's cheaper, it's robust, it's reliable, and all of that. And the power, the major thing to me is the power is shifting to the masses, to community building of technology, and not to one monopoly, which is which has the say in deciding what version comes out next and how much of an improvement will the next version have. Well, we saw that the digital divide was certainly diminishing. I also find that the cultural divide is diminishing. I'm going to speak about this in the Popular Cultural Association conference that's forthcoming in San Diego. And it's about how each of these applications have the Western metaphor imposed in a very subtle way in them. Just like I was speaking about the subaltern, can the subaltern speak? So we have been, when I say we, I mean non-West, non-Microsoft. This is not specifically to India. But icons of files and folders, like when computers came to India, we had these yellow file folder icon. I did not know what that is. Did you know, Shyam? You knew what that thing meant? Okay, I didn't. Only after I came here and I saw the yellow files being used, I was like, oh, okay. I sort of conceptually knew, it was a file, it's a directory and all that, but actually how the metaphor, how it's represented, how the iconization was something, that was a revelation to me. It's the yellow file folder that's being transposed on the computer screen, which I did not know in India. A lot of my friends also did not know that in India. So things like that, the recycle bin, that's now the thing. So a lot of Western metaphors, the toolkit, a lot of those things are also, I feel, the iconization itself is not allowing the subaltern to speak. So will that be transformed is something that I am still looking at. I am looking at the open source applications developed by some institutes in Madras and Delhi, because they are developing Punjabi is a language in India, Punjabi Linux, Tamil Linux and all that. So I don't know if that will change, but that's a Western imposition, according to me. And there are cultural and ideological shifts as well. The changing work ethic. People work nights. People never used to work weekends, but people sit there in the office all weekends. That's Protestant. Is that a Protestant work ethic? Probably. It's the work ethic has changed, basically. They work on U.S. time simply because they have to team up with their U.S. counterparts and work synchronously. So that has changed. So a lot of cultural and ideological shifts due to outsourcing. Changing names to Western names. When you call somebody for customer service and they said, I'm Bob, what do you want? It's probably my friend Barani because his name was Bob when he was working for a technology support center. So changing names and developing a Western accent. You all know people are trained to develop a Western accent. So that's part of it. It just grows into them. So it's there is an ideological shift and dialogue modalities like, how are you? Have a nice day. That was not existing before. Now, local companies, local customer service, they don't have to be outsourced, but just local companies, they make it a point to say, how are you? Have a nice day. You know, that's changed. The work ethic has changed is what I think. So the cultural divide is also narrowing. I don't know if that's good or bad. What do you guys think? Bad? One bad?
You can go both ways. We're hoping it will go good.
Yep.
And, you know,
sorry.
Too, but there are some limits on the way the iPads are set up, even for us, if we feel some limits to that.
Okay.
So, you know, the import of different cultural perspective as the power of changing some things that we'd like to change here, too.
Do you have some examples? You said some icons are, you feel it's imposed on you, like,
right.
Do you have some examples to give?
I think the first time I saw that little file, too, I wondered what it was.
Okay.
It's like, oh, okay, that's a minimal file. But, I think it's not necessarily one culture against another culture. It's, this culture has a wide range within it. And, Bill Gates some ideas on this that we're going to have to divide it.
I like your idea that it's not culture against culture. Yeah. I'm sorry, somebody else had their hand up before.
You said that the expressions that are being used in local Indian businesses are using Americanisms, American.
Yeah.
What do you think is responsible for that? If they don't have to use it outside of India, why do they use these expressions for local businesses?
I guess it's just the way a majority of the people, why for working in outsourced companies, in outsourcing. It doesn't matter if it's a call center. It doesn't matter if it does not match their skill set. They want to be there in the call center. I've spoken to a lot of people who want to be there, who want to be in the technology support center, even though they don't see a future. As they go into it, they don't see a future in it. They want to get out of it, but they want to be there. It's sort of a fad to work in a call center or a tech support center for Netgear. You know, it's cool. So it's just like MTV was cool. Madonna pierced her nose, and then no strings came back. She wore the mehndi in her video Frozen, and then that came back. And Gwen Stefani, she wore the bindi, and that came back into vogue. So, you know, it just goes a full circle. I guess it's just a cool thing. Yes?
Well, because Linux is open source, I'm certain that what we will see are that Indian programmers will take advantage of the fact that it is open source and make contributions to KDE and GNOME and other window managers so that people could select a variety of different icons to use files and recycle bins, etc.
They are doing that. There are some projects. There are some projects in an institute called TNET, TelecomNet, part of the Indian Institute of Technology. They develop a lot of local applications, and they're doing that. It's slow. It's still in a beginning, initial phase, but I think they will do it. So.
Because, once they make those contributions, that'd be also something that, you know, people here in the West could, you know, may want to take advantage of, and you know, hey, you know, this icon looks cool. Let's use this instead of the file or the recycle bin or.
Yeah.
The conqueror icon or Mozilla.
Yeah, it's possible. But I don't know if the thinking is still, you know, because they've been exposed to the file, you know, such an organization directory file. It's just there. Would it be possible to change the working of the operating system itself too?
The window manager and the operating system are two different things. The window manager is giving you a graphical interface to actually control the underlying OS. So the window manager can easily be changed, and I don't think that's going to be. That should be difficult.
So they will probably do it. As of now, I don't think they're doing it. They sort of follow the same icons. But yeah, it's quite possible that, you know, we suddenly faced with a new... I may not know what that is. It's because it's from the northeast part of India. So it's possible. Yeah, that'll be interesting. Yep.
I think that one of the difficulties of this pushback on Western culture is particularly here. When we think of Unix, the beauty of Unix is everything you look at in a file. It's kind of natural to think about a file in a bunch of files that you're actually setting. So a lot of things are just really in this context. And how much of that really affects what happens on top, and where do you have opportunity for non-Western audience to come in? And not necessarily a bad thing to change those ideas.
You mean change the basic structure of an operating system itself?
And maybe that won't work. Maybe there isn't much room for pushback. So I think it's a little more complicated than just changing an icon. It's really maybe change.
Yeah, so how difficult is it to change that, or will it take a long time? I don't know.
So. I think everything is
I just like to add that one of the reasons that this sort of thing hasn't happened, for example, Indians contributing to the open source movement seems to be probably because of availability of resources. Access to the internet is still a premium in India.
That's true.
It's not, you don't get high-speed access. You know, it's only recently that high-speed access is becoming common. And even now, I think there's probably 1% of India's population has access to the internet from home. I've been a developer for about 10, 12 years now. Bulk of it has been in India. And I never owned a computer in India. I never had internet access from home in India. So it's something that you do at work. You just couldn't afford to have a computer at home and then access at home, for example, which is so much more expensive. But I think as that changes, you'll see a lot more contribution. Because there's a lot of skilled resources there, but they're just not able to contribute because they don't have the resources.
Or they don't have the necessity because you cannot pay your electric bill online. You have to go stand in the queue to pay the electricity bill. So, you know, the system has to change, probably. There's no need for people to access the internet.
The other, another example would be, the city I come from is Pune. It's a very popular place, you know, it's a very open city. It's a big population, like I think 4+ million or something. But even till day, even now, we have 3 hours of power outages every single day. So it's like scheduled outages every day throughout the year. That's what we live with. So, you know, it's just, you can't imagine a life like digital. It's just not the same. So I think as that changes, you know, you'll see that contributions and such will also change.
Yeah, that's a digital divide within India itself. It's really good. Broadband connection in cities are very good. You know, they're fast. I accessed internet 24 hours when I went back to India. But the rural areas, which is 73.2, they don't have the internet access. So there's a huge gap there.
How about in the schools, the universities? Do they have, I think like IIT, for example, should have.
They do.
Very good, reliable broadband access.
Yes.
And certainly many of the computer science students at IIT are some of the brightest in the world. I'm certain that many of them are taking advantage of the fact that they do have broadband there, at least when they go to the university. No? Or
what, yes, what they are.
Okay, do they have to wait in line to use their computer?
No, there are many labs. I think IIT, in terms of giving its resources to students, is pretty good. And
that's one of the big ways in which people get access to resources like computers and internet is either through their schools, universities, or then at work. That's just basically how it goes.
And so will we see contributions to the open source software through the universities and through the corporate world?
It's happening. Yeah, I'm going to just outline a few projects that's happening in IIT Madras and as part of the iLUG in Delhi. So they're doing a good initial job of that. They've actually taken sustainable technology to rural areas, so that's a big deal. They don't have to depend, the villages don't have to depend outside of their village to support the technologies. Once they're set up, they're just self-sustenant. So they're doing a pretty good job, actually, but they haven't been able to cover a lot of the villages. They're beginning it. Did anybody else have a comment? Yeah.
So what's the difference between India and, say, China, if you have to know?
Mm-hmm. I've not studied China, but I would think that there is not so much of a cultural/language barrier in China. Anybody here? Okay. So I don't know. I'll look it up though, certainly. I'll make a note of it. Okay. So the cultural divide is narrowing. I don't know if that's good or bad. It's like saying, leave the tribes alone. They don't need technology. They can just till their land. I'm part of this non-profit organization called AID, which is Association for India's Development, and we constantly have this debate in our meetings. We call them community service hours. The thing is, there is this Adivasi tribal village somewhere in northeast India, and we do not know whether to take a certain technology to them, because by teaching them the technology, you take the tribalness out of them. One culture goes away. So there's this debate, you know, who are we to say it's right? Who are we to deny progress to the tribes? Or who are we to say, you know, let them be, we need their cultures? We don't know. So I think it's sort of the similar question. So that's what Benjamin Barber, I've borrowed these terms also from Dr. Benjamin Barber. He looks at globalization from a very cynical viewpoint. It's either going to be jihad or it's going to be Macworld. Jihad meaning the entire world is split into warring tribes and they just war and die. They don't die, they just war among each other, one another. And Macworld, everything is homogenized, everything is McDonaldized. So that's his theory. That's his viewpoint of globalization. It's either this or that. So we don't know. So these are some of the projects, just a sneak peek of the projects that's taking place in India right now. Linux compatibility with Microsoft, IBM, and Sun software to make a homogeneous platform to link all users while still customizing the software to accommodate the various languages, icons, file names, fonts, etc. This is done by iLUG Delhi. I like Chennai has built a TSEII to edit TSE files and has a set of Tamil fonts and an HTML editor. And it also is involved in current localization efforts in 10 different Indian languages. I think that's part of InLinux, which is a project in IIT Madras. So that's InLinux. And they, too many points on the slide, but important points. So they, This project has established internet kiosks in rural areas. They have taken sustainable technology to the villages. So an internet kiosk is set up this way. There's a computer, there's a phone line, and you know, people can come. They have a locally tailored application wherein the villages can talk to their government, the local government panchayats, who then will take it to, you know, the next level of the government. So they have customized applications, and they're taking it to the rural areas, which is a good initial step. And like I said, they're all sustainable technology. So once they have been set up and once they are running, the villages do not have to depend on outside resources. They have an income from there, and they, in turn, contribute to that. So it's sustainable. So that's a great thing. So yeah, another thing is, like we discussed, that in India, majority of the population does not speak English. So they are involved in developing native language software, and they're faced with problems like font creation, because if you've seen Indian languages, the way they're written, they're rounded. The vowel placement is different, and the thickness of one word may not be the thickness of the other letter. So they have to actually draw the glyphs to do that, and hence they have a problem in cursor positioning. So they're addressing a lot of these problems, and they're working on it. They do not want to, you know, do anything else. They don't want to develop applications, but they want to develop the operating system itself, because that's better. They can do it for their native languages, the localization project. And they want to do it in Linux because they say it's robust, stable, and free. Those are the words from them. So they prefer Linux. So having seen all this, these are some of the paradigm shifts that I see, again, back to the globalization loom. You know, these are some of the threads that come together. Ongoing transformations in notions and centers of power from state and the market to that of technology. New and old technologies have so far caused the digital divide to widen. Decentralized grassroots technology closing the divides, including cultural divides, and we don't know whether it's good or bad. Grassroots movements that build technoscapes are simultaneously homogeneous and heterogeneous. They're homogeneous because they bring together the entire world, they have a common platform, they have transcended time and space and geography and everything. They can just communicate at an instant. They have a common knowledge base that they can take from when communicating. Yet, we're hoping they'd be heterogeneous because of all these localization efforts. So at this point, I see this particular point in time space as postmodern globalization, which I, in another paper, have called it unglobalization. It's a point in time space where there's local and global information produced at local and global levels and transmitted across and available at local and global levels. So it's sort of information is there everywhere. You know about the globe, you know about the local levels. It's there's so much of information, so globalization will begin again. So it's sort of a metamorphosis. That's what I'm trying to propose. So we have the twain meet, the East and the West, top and bottom flows, global and local flows, homogeneity and heterogeneity, and technology and culture. So far, a lot of scholars said the twain would never meet. East would still be the East, West would still be the West, with respect to power and the masses. They also cannot meet because the power will always be the powerful and the masses will have to listen to the powerful. Local and global, again, homogeneity, heterogeneity, which we've discussed in depth. And technology and culture, it's beautiful because I think it's Stephen Johnson, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, in Interface Culture, he talks about the coming together of technology and culture, how technology itself is an ideology wherein you manifest your culture. So that's what he talks about. Has anybody read the book, Interface Culture? So that's what he talks about. Interface is basically, whatever the backbone may be, how it's manifested in interface is different, and that comes from culture, and technology becomes ideology. So, done. Questions, comments, suggestions? Thank you. Yeah.
You kind of touched on a little bit. You spoke about whether you use your technology to remote villages, kind of take away their problems, et cetera. But my question is slightly different than that. How useful is it to have email? And really, you can more concerned about the crops that you're planting will grow. And obviously, being here, you understand the technology is fully supportive, but sometimes it is just seems like people assume it's a panacea and really doesn't fix the core problem that people in third world countries have.
one take, the other take on that is, why can't the tribals migrate to the cities? Why should they stay where they are? Why should they cultivate? You know, so some of the tribal groups that approached us as part of the organization, they said, you know, we want to migrate to the cities. We don't want to do this. We don't want our kids to farm and cultivate at the base of the mountains. We don't want them to do this. So do we have the right to deny them to migrate to the cities? Because we are there in the cities. So it's a dilemma. It's just ideology, I think. Any other question? Commons. I'm not very technically. I'm not a technical person. So if I had, you know, misstated something, please pardon me, and correct me also. So please let me know if I'd said something wrong. Yes.
Do you have a list of sources?
Yes, I will put it as a link in this presentation, and I'll probably give it to Shyam, because he mentioned it would be on the website. So I'll do that. I'll certainly do that. Thanks. All right, then. Thank you so much. It's a great honor to be among all of you. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's presentation from Scale 3X. Notes and slides from this presentation are available on the podcast website at socallinuxexpo.org/podcast. The Southern California Linux Expo is a community-run, nonprofit Linux and open-source conference. If you are interested in hearing more talks such as this one, please consider joining us at our next event on February 11th and 12th, 2006. For more information, see our website at socallinuxexpo.org.